Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about design and transport. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We're chatting art, transport, communications and history, that's C-A-T-C-H, I call it the Catchcast, and we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful, if slightly geeky subjects, as myself and the fascinating guests. In this edition, the editor of one of Britain's best-known and much-loved railway newspapers. Welcome to the Catchcast, Sim Harris.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being here, Sim. And we're going to get to discuss your excellent newspaper, your podcast and your forthcoming book. But can we start by taking you right back to your upbringing and ask, when did you first get interested by railways?
I suppose it was probably when I was being brought up in Cornwall. We lived near a little local station called a platform in those days. Today it's just an unstaffed halt, but it's still there. Dr. Beeching wanted to get rid of it, but he didn't. And we used to go on the train from there into Newquay. And I remember when I was about six, I was very frightened of steam engines. And I used to walk along the platform, pressing myself against the wall at the back at Newquay Station to be as far away as possible from this frightening thing.
You can just imagine what steam engines must have looked like to people who'd never seen any kind of mechanical thing at all, can't you, when they first arrived in, well, Victorian times, I suppose.
Well, it wasn't quite that far back.
No, not for you. But this got you keen and interested in trains, despite your fear of the steam engines then?
Not trains, I wouldn't say, really. I still struggle with class numbers, and people talk about all the class 802 so-and-so. Well, actually, we have class 802s in Cornwall, but no, it's not trains. It came to be the railway industry, the mechanism, how it works, and indeed how it looks, and rolling stock has got part of that. But I've never stood at the end of a platform collecting numbers except once. I had a younger cousin, and I was only 14, and he told me what fun it would be. So we tried it for a few weeks during the summer, and I was never so bored. So no, that's not my thing. I'm not a railway enthusiast. I could say I'm an enthusiast about railways, if you see the difference.
Nice difference. So when you left school then, what did you end up studying or working as?
Well, our family moved back to London when I was 11. And I went to a grammar school in North London. I won't name it, because I hated it. I'd had a really good time at school in Cornwall, and this seemed hostile and different, and I didn't get on with it. I did my O-levels there and was so utterly distracted by the business of going to school, I decided to leave school. I got a job as a library assistant, which wasn't really my ambition in life, but nonetheless, that's what I did at the age of 17. And once I got that and I was earning money, I did my A-levels as what's called a private candidate. So I taught myself and got a couple of A-levels, not brilliant grades, but they were good enough. And I then went to college, but I went to study librarianship because I was in that business. And I duly qualified, and 3 years later, I was a chartered librarian.
Wow.
Went back to work. First of all, I worked for a firm of architects as their photograph librarian. That's when I got interested in images. I was able to mix with some of the finest photographers, architectural photographers, in London. And I learned a lot from them, and I learned about composing a picture. And after a while, I was sent out to take pictures for the practice myself, and they got used. I was much taken with the day I was sent to Piccadilly Circus to get a picture of Eros, the statue, for the partner who was going to do a lecture which involved that. And I managed to get pictures of Eros reflected in nearby windows. And architects love reflections. And I took it back, and the slide was duly processed. It was on slides. And when I laid them out on the light desk in my little photo library, he came up to see. He said, oh, that's a beautiful picture. And I thought, oh, well, here we are. I'm getting the hang of this. But I didn't stay there forever. The money wasn't brilliant. There was no chance of promotion. And it was a lot of commuting every day. So I went back to work for the library service for a while, but got more and more bored with it, and discovered also I didn't really like librarians. I didn't really get on with them very well. They were a bit placid for me. So I then decided I really wanted to work in broadcasting. So I went and volunteered for a hospital radio station. And then a new one was set up. And while I was at that one, I was presenting my own news programme called Newswatch, because I was always on the journalistic side. A new local radio station got the franchise for Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. And I thought, how do I get in there? I know, I'll interview the managing director. So I invited them, that is to say, he and his programme controller, onto my hospital radio programme. Then I was able to show off as an interviewer. And it got me an interview with them. And that was the beginning. And I got initially just a freelance job presenting the classical music programme. But also, 3 days before we were due to go live, one of the people on the morning programme, who was supposed to be the news voice, couldn't read bulletins. He couldn't do it. He could speak, but he was no good with a script. And the 3 days before we went live, they said, "Sim, we can offer you the job as the morning news reader." So they did that, and we launched, and the start-up sequence was badly timed, and I ended up being the first live voice on the station. I wasn't supposed to be, but that's how it happened.
The joy of live radio.
A month later, the editor, who was a very good editor, taught me a lot, said, "Look, I can't go on using you as a news reader. We're not the BBC. But I've got a choice. I can either have a newsroom secretary or a second trainee. Money's not brilliant, but would you like the job?" Now, that's hen's teeth, getting a job as a trainee journalist in local radio in the 80s. So I did it, lived rather austerely for a year, then got promoted to being a JLR2, it was known as, Journalist Local Radio 2, and then a JLR1. At that point, you can run a newsroom. And that's what I did. But I still remember my very last day working for the library service. By then, I was running the mobile library because it got me away from other librarians. And I had a lovely couple came in every Friday at one of our stops. They were a lovely old pair. And I said, "Well, this is going to be the last time you see me." They said, "Oh, you're not leaving." And I said, "Yes, I am." "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to read the news on the wireless." Which was a bit of a leap, I suppose, from being a librarian in North London. Anyway, once I had done that, I then was moved at the radio station I worked for to run the newsroom in another station they'd just taken over. The contractors there had gone bust, and the Independent Broadcasting Authority offered it to our managing director. So we had a second string in Northampton. So I went to work for that. But I wasn't going to get any further. I'd started barely as a trainee, and I was now a JLR1 running a newsroom. I wasn't going to get any further promotion. You have to move on.
What did you do next?
Well, yes, I worked for LBC and Capital. I then got a slightly more definite job as the acting editor of Devonair, which, funnily enough, is in Devon, or at least it was. And it had a lovely old house on St. David's Hill in Exeter. And I used to drive down there regularly. But after a while, I found driving very dull. I lived in Bedfordshire, so it was a fair old way back on a Friday evening. And the M5 on Friday evening wasn't charming. And I found myself thinking, "Oh, it's Almondsbury Interchange again." And after a while, I investigated, perhaps I could go by train, and discovered that actually from a tax point of view, I was better off. I could go first class and put everything against tax. You can't claim cars to quite that extent. And I felt I wanted to leave the car in Bedfordshire. So I did. So I went to Exeter every week, every weekend by train, stayed the week and came back on Friday evening and enjoyed myself a lot more. So that's where I was. And then I was talking to a friend who was very keen to get into media training, which is teaching people how to be interviewed. You teach all the worthy things. One is, for example, the question doesn't matter, it is the answer that counts. So you're in charge of this. You might think that the person doing the interview is, but they're not, because they are completely stuck with what you say. And another very good piece of advice, never let them put words in your mouth. So if, for example, you're doing some big critical thing after an accident, say, and the interviewer asks you, are you feeling guilty about this? You don't say, I am not feeling guilty about this. They've just put that word in your mouth. Not a good word. No, the answer is, well, those are your words, not mine. So we did that for several years. We had quite a few corporate clients. But we started with a railway client, and that's where the railway link started.
Right.
Just at the time of privatisation, it was one of the companies that had been set up but yet to be sold off. And they were all very keen to put themselves about, to be interviewed and to make a good impression. So we had them for a while. Then we had other. We had a water company on one occasion. And I remember we were staying at a hotel, and it often included a couple of nights at a nice hotel at their expense and dinner and everything. And one evening we were sitting in the conservatory, and it was pouring with rain outside and hammering on the glass. And one of these water company executives looked up and said, ah, product.
Today we're talking with the editor of one of Britain's most respected railway newspapers, Sim Harris. One of you can tell us about your career with the BBC.
Yes, I did various things. I went to work for Radio London in its closing days and was there for the transition to what was called GLR, Greater London Radio. It was all right. It was not a bad place to be. But I started to look around the BBC and see what else there is. And for a while, I was a Radio 4 continuity announcer, reading the shipping forecast and all that kind of thing. I think my favourite thing there was an arts programme every afternoon at 4:30, and it was live. And I was the duty announcer. And the announcer, you may not think it, but is in charge of the network. And at about 20 past four, the fax whirred and out came a gale warning. Now, there was a very firm instruction at the BBC, and still is, I'm sure. Gale warnings must be, and I quote, radiated at the next programme junction and repeated in the following bulletin. Turning that into English, it meant that it had to be broadcast at 16:30, because that was the next break, and it would be repeated at the end of the opening news bulletin in PM at 5 o'clock. And you had to do it. There'd been a bit of a row before I was there, luckily, over one sad incident where some yachts people died, and the BBC was accused of not broadcasting a gale warning. I don't think the accusation was right, but the BBC was very sensitive, and so gale warnings had absolute three-star flashing blue lights priority. And I had to ring down to the studio of the arts programme, and I said to the producer, ah, hello, R4 Continuity here. Just to let you know, we'll be coming to you about 16:30, 45, because I have to do a gale warning. And she said, you can't do that. I said, oh, I can. In fact, I must. The DG is very sensitive about it. There will be a gale warning. And bear in mind, I had the faders in front of me. She couldn't go on air unless I opened the right fader. And I wasn't going to. I knew my instructions. And so she said, but you can't. We've got Michael Winner. And I said, frankly, it doesn't matter if you've got the Queen Mother. I'm still coming to you at 16:34. But I rather enjoyed doing it somehow.
I bet you did.
We got to the end of the previous programme, which was on tape. And so I did the usual thing. You're listening to BBC Radio 4. In a moment, Kaleidoscope. But before that, attention all shipping. The following warning was issued by the Met Office at so-and-so-and-so-and-so. And I read it quite deliberately and quite slowly, thinking of all the Michael Winner that the nation was not going to hear.
Bravo.
Very wicked, really.
Bravo, but, bravo. I'm glad you did that. Otherwise, we'd have had to suffer even more of it.
Well, yes. And they never did have the Queen Mother on.
But, she would have anyway, had to wait for Gales.
So we
as
had
well.
Fun. We had fun.
You did. Today, we are with Sim Harris, who's the editor of Rail News. Sim, can you tell us a little bit about the background to this in-house journal? I think it started in the 1960s. Is that right?
It started in July 1963.
Ah.
And it was an invention of, hold your breath, Dr. Beeching.
Ah.
He was chairman at the time. Up to then, there had been about five regional magazines, which were descended from the company magazines before nationalisation. And it was decided to pull them all together and go from magazine to newspaper format, call it Rail News. But because there were the different regions, there were what are called in the trade slip pages. Now, a slip page is one that only appears in a particular edition, and it doesn't appear in the others. So they could personalise it, say, for the Western region or the Scottish region, but it was fundamentally the same paper, a national railway newspaper for the first time.
And how did you get yourself involved then?
Oh, by not looking where I was going. I'd been running a publishing company. This was after the BBC days, publishing a railway directory called Keeping Track. It was very successful for some years. But then along came the internet, and the internet killed off all directories. I mean, when did you last look at a printed phone directory?
Good point.
They don't exist.
No,
Yellow Pages
no.
has gone.
All gone.
There is no purpose to it. So there I was, feeling a bit broke with something else to do, the company being wound up, and I heard from a colleague that Rail News was looking for a reporter. And I thought, well, that might be amusing. That might be a bit more than amusing. So when I got in touch, it turned out that they wanted a reporter initially, but that the present editor was soon going to go very part-time and didn't want to be editor anymore. And they were therefore really looking for an editor. And that's how it came to be. I had an interview, actually sitting by a canal in Leighton Buzzard, which is a nice place to be interviewed, really, with a pint in front of you. That's very Rail News. We're always like that. And I got the job and started at the end of September 09. And the very first thing I did, because the others were still producing that edition, so I started off by going and covering a story. And it involved getting a refurbished HST from Leicester to London. That story was that they were upgrading the HSTs. And the first thing I managed to do was miss the train. So I had to follow by a following train, got to St Pancras, found the HST, found the chap, very nice chap, in charge of the refurbishment, did the story, took the pictures, and all was well. Rail News was a bit old-fashioned. It hadn't had anything like a refresh for a very long time, and it took me several years. But we had a new look completely in 2014, and I stayed as managing editor. Other people have come and gone. I work with a great little team now, very good managing director, lovely guy called David, and I have a splendid pair of colleagues. One is our layout man, who is a designer of much experience, and also a chap who still works in the railway to a considerable extent, called Phil Marsh. But he is an avid photographer, and he is our, if you like, in-house railwayman. He can tell you about Schedule 8 and Schedule 4 and delay minutes and all kinds of things. So we try to get the technicalities right, although I've learned a bit over the years. And here I still am. We're now doing a relaunch in April. We will have another new look, because it is, after all, 12 years since the last one. New websites are coming along. And the other thing is a book, about the railway called The Railway Image. That's all happening in April.
I'm going to come on to your book in a minute.
And we'll come back to that in a moment.
We certainly will. Yeah. But just picking up on your point about the history of the journal, it was never really designed for people like railway enthusiasts or even the heritage railway market, was it? It was very much a sort of in-house newsletter.
It was British Rail's in-house newspaper. So that's nothing to do with railway enthusiasts. In fact, railway enthusiasts were not terribly welcome at British Rail. They felt that somebody who was an enthusiast would concentrate on the wrong things. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I don't endorse that view and I don't condemn it, but that was the view. As for heritage railways, you're right. Again, not really, although British Rail did have one, the Vale of Rheidel, until the 80s. But you're right. No, it was the modern railway they were concerned with. It was the business of the British Railways Board. So Rail News, we have a full back file every issue since 1963. And there is a tremendous social history to be told from that. But there was the introduction and then the failure of the APT. There was the introduction of the HST, very much more successful. There was the end of steam. There was decimalisation, which British Rail went out on a bit of a limb, or down their own siding, you might say, by doing it a day early. They decimalised the currency on the 14th of February 71, not the 15th. And they had to say that if anybody didn't want the new decimal coppers in their change, well, they had the right to demand old-style money. Yeah, it was in very small print. They didn't really want you to know that. But technically they were right, because the new decimal penny and tuppence wouldn't be legal currency till the following day. So all those things were covered at length, and most of all, perhaps controversially, was the changeover from British Railways to British Rail. Mm. And it didn't impress many Rail News readers. They thought it was a bit of nonsense. There were huge numbers of things to be improved, but changing the colour or changing the lettering wasn't one of them, in their view. So that was a controversial time, and again, we have the backfile to prove it. And I suppose the other big controversy was at the beginning of the 80s, when there was a major industrial dispute, and it got so bad that the chairman, Sir Peter Parker, considered closing the railway.
Goodness
closing
me.
Closing it down,
wow.
Stopping it.
Wow.
And it was an incredible crisis, looking back on it. Briefly, Rail News, which had always been monthly, went weekly to cover it. And it was the voice of management, no doubt about that. It was not a balanced, objective newspaper. The unions had their own newspapers and they could get on with it. So it was the voice of the management. And they were trying to persuade all the staff of British Rail, don't walk out because you might not come back.
And wow.
That was a very heavy period, long before my time. But again, I've seen it in the back file.
And isn't it just a fantastic resource for nutcase researchers like myself? And we're still with Rail News editor Sim Harris. And Sim, I believe you recently started a podcast. How's that been going?
We did. We started it in summer 24. And indeed, our first edition was all about the result of the election. And so we had clips of people like Sir Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. And that was the launch, because apart from the general importance of the election, the manifesto included, of course, proposals, indeed pledges, to renationalise the passenger railway, an important moment.
And we just had a few more announcements recently about the Northern Rail situation, didn't we?
We have. And what got everybody terribly excited was the mention of restoring a line along what would have been the alignment of HS2 between the West Midlands, Lichfield strictly, and Manchester. And I had to disappoint them all and say, look, this is very long term. It's a very long term thing. I don't think a lot of us will be here by the time that opens. They are going to use the land. They're not going to sell it as the previous government had wanted to, but don't get too excited. That's a very far away thing. Much more reasonable and likely is the new railway between Liverpool and Manchester. Mm. And they were disappointed. Mm. They wanted the headline, HS2 restored to Manchester. No, I don't think you're going to get that one.
No, I think we'll be, you and me won't be catching those trains. You teased us a little bit earlier on with this idea of this wonderful new book you've been working on. Can you tell us about it, please, Sim?
Well, wonderful is not a word I would use. That's something that I'll have to find out about. Yes, it was an idea to do something in connection with Railway 200. And they have the exhibition train. But we wanted to do something about Railway 200, but we didn't want to do just another book about trains. As you gather, my sympathy isn't really with the rolling stock as it is. And I decided to look instead at the world of communication, how the railway had talked to its audiences since 1825, how it worked in print. And so we came up, or I did, came up with a title, The Railway Image, The Railway's Print Design and Identity. And we're not talking about locomotives, we're not talking even about architecture. I'm more interested in, as I say, the railway image, particularly on paper. And I've been going through hundreds and hundreds of documents, many of which are littering up my house at the moment. But I have here, just in front of me, I was scanning it before we met this morning. I've got here Rambles in the Chiltern Country,
oh, lovely.
A 1949 book published by the Railway Executive in the days when the railway was still a publisher. And dear old British Railways, they just couldn't do something and have the courage of it because the lawyers no doubt were in the background. And there is a box on the front page saying, "Caution! Whilst endeavour has been made to ensure correctness in the composition of this guide and the reliability of the information contained in it, the Railway Executive do not guarantee its accuracy, nor do they accept responsibility for the information given or for errors or omissions." My goodness, it's only a guide to walks in the Chiltern Country. But there we are. That was the railway at the time, and that was the way it used to do things. It was awfully correct. And I've made all kinds of discoveries. I was particularly pleased to find that one intercity snack, briefly available in 1992, and you'll see why it was briefly in a moment, it was a bun. And it had ingredients of four colours, and the colours were important because it was called the electoral roll.
Aha.
And so it had mustard for the yellow party, and I can't remember what it had for blue. It had something. But they managed to get in four colours. They didn't have any purple in those days. It was only on sale for a very few weeks, and it had to stop being sold by the time the election happened. And I have a copy. In fact, I have the actual label myself. I don't think many of those would have survived.
No, I thought you were actually going to say you had an actual electoral roll there. I think, crikey, it's going to be a bit rotten by now.
No, I ate that.
It feels a bit like the railways have lost their way graphically since the introduction of the double arrow on the rail alphabet in 1960,
oh,
doesn't
Lord,
it?
Oh, Lord, yes, hugely so. And the reason for that was privatisation.
Mm.
You have the new corporate identity in 1965, which never worked that well for print, by the way. If you look at the manual, and I have two sets of the original manual, you will find that so many different typefaces were allowed. It ought to be this, but if that's not available, you can use this.
Mm.
And if this isn't available, you can use that. You don't get a corporate feel by doing that. And in fact, if you go through the next few years, the print identity decayed more and more. It went its own way more and more.
Mm.
So although the signage on stations, and indeed the insignia on rolling stock, there I am talking about rolling stock now, but the insignia on that did stay very to point, the print side went in all kinds of directions. Then in the 80s we had the business-led railway and the creation of intercity provincial railways, later regional, and Network South East. And that introduced three new identities, But lo and behold, after a few years of that, they were all thrown into the air with the privatisation. Yeah. And what had been three identities for the passenger railway became 25.
Oh, dear.
And my goodness, what a mixture. And that's why it lost its way, because there's no consistency. There are some things which, as a matter of communication, I do find annoying. One, you might think they don't come into it, but they do. Ticket vending machines. Mm. Every operator has a different supplier, I would guess, and their own layout. So if you're used to the Great Western machines and you're travelling on, say, a Transpennine Express, it's all different. Now, that's the kind of thing I would hope that Great British Railways will haul back and say, no, there is one National Rail ticket vending machine and it looks like this and it presents the customer with these options. No messing. That kind of consistency has been lost. And I think when you say losing its way, that I think is what you're talking about.
Very much so. And my last question exactly on this subject, and you've already touched on it, is what are your hopes for railway images in the sort of post-GBR world?
Well, we're already seeing them. Where I live in Cornwall, Great Western Railway has been very busy replacing station signs with Rail Alphabet 2. And good. It's done it not merely at the main stations, but down the branch lines as well.
Good, good.
And they've moved ahead on that. And Mark Hopwood at Great Western has been very sporting because he's going to lose Great Western later this year. But that is already happening. And the sooner the better.
Absolutely.
Let's get a consistent scheme of communication on stations again. Let's get consistent documents. And let's get a consistent face electronically, whether it's a ticket vending machine or whether it's a website.
Mm.
Let the railway speak with one voice, not 20 or 25.
What a brilliant way to end a fantastic chat. We could go on talking for ages, I know about that, and it's been an absolute privilege to chat with such a real esteemed fellow railway enthusiast, editor, and soon-to-be book author, Sim Harris. Thanks for joining us, Sim.
Great pleasure.
Hope you've enjoyed listening to Sim as much as I have. You can find the journal at railnews.co.uk. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting, art, transport, communications, and history, so please do join us then.